So impressed. So what we're going to do is I'm going to first start off by telling you why are we going to be studying the book of Exodus, what the book of Exodus is about, and then we'll jump into chapter 5 and we'll go verse by verse by verse, all right? So first of all, why the book of Exodus? Like, why study the second book in the Bible, this dusty old book back in the Old Testament? Well, here's why. If we were to summarize the book of Exodus in one sentence, it would be this. God's people drawn out of darkness and are drawn into his light. That God's people were in slavery and they were in bondage, and God drew them out into the wilderness, into his presence. And the Exodus story can be your story. That's what God's inviting us into. That God takes his people and he draws them and delivers them out of bondage and draws them into deeper intimacy with himself. That's why we should care about this book this morning. So what is going on in the book of Exodus? And for us to understand what's going on in the book of Exodus, we need to go back to the beginning, Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. It was a perfect heaven and earth. There was no sin, there was no pain. But then, because of humans' rebellion, brokenness entered into the world. Yet in the midst of that rebellion, God promises redemption. Now, how is God going to bring redemption to all this brokenness and all this sin, all this death into the world? We fast forward to Genesis chapter 12, and in Genesis chapter 12, God goes to a man by the name of Abram. And he goes to Abram and says, listen, I'm going to rescue and I'm going to bless this rebellious world through your family. And then what's fascinating is three chapters later, in chapter 15, God says, oh, by the way, your people are going to be in slavery for 400 years. So when we get to Exodus chapter 1, God's people, the family of Abram, has been in slavery for 400 years. And that's where we're going to be at this morning. Now, before we jump into chapter 5, I want to give you a little bit of context of what happened in chapter 4. In chapter 4, God gives Moses three signs to perform before Pharaoh. So what were those three signs that God gave Moses to perform? What were the three signs that God gave Moses to perform? I'm sorry? So the snake, the first sign was the staff. He threw a staff into the ground, turned his head by the tail. If you're going to pick up a snake, you should pick it up by the head, not tail. But he picks it up by the tail and turns back into his staff. What's the second sign? Leprosy. So no leprosy, leprosy, no leprosy. That was the second sign. Third sign. What was the third sign he was to perform? The water. So here is the Nile River, right? Here's a cup of the Nile River water. Pours out. When it makes contact with the ground, it turns to blood. Here's why that's important. Those are not just random signs. Those are not just like magic tricks that he's performing to impress Pharaoh. There's a reason behind each one. Let's talk about the snake for a moment. It's interesting because Pharaoh, on his crown, he actually had a snake, specifically a cobra, that was like flared out and like ready to strike. And that snake on his crown represented all of Egypt's power and their sovereign rule. And so when Pharaoh puts on this crown, he is now the most powerful god in Egypt. And God comes in and says, your power is nothing. I can turn a snake into a staff. I can turn a staff into a snake. Second sign, leprosy. Here's the thing about leprosy. Leprosy was one of the most highly contagious and one of the most feared diseases in the ancient world at that time. And Egypt had been pouring a lot of resources and their brightest minds toward curing leprosy, and they couldn't do it. And God comes in and says, what you can't cure, I can cure. I have power here. Third sign, the Nile being turned into blood. What's interesting is Egypt is in a desert area, and the Nile River would actually bring 30 feet of black soil into the desert. Egypt ran off the Nile River. And it's interesting because if you were to ask, if you were to describe America in one word, what would be the one word you would use to describe America? Home of the free, right? Freedom. If you were to ask the people in Egypt, what's the one word that describes y'all, it would be Nile. It's the home of the Nile. And yet God takes this source of power. They considered it to be this the father of life, the mother of all the divine spirit that blessed the land. And God comes in and takes this source of power and turns into blood. So we have a snake that represented Egyptian power. We have leprosy representing what Egypt had no power over. We have the Nile River, the source of Egypt's power. And God says, I have power over all these things. So when we get to chapter 5, Moses is entering into Egypt. And he's like, I'm back, but now I got signs. It's going to be great. He's got these signs on his side. So with that said, based off what we know about the history of the Hebrew people, that they've been in slavery for 400 years, and now Moses, the deliverer that God's raised up, is coming in with these three signs, how are the Hebrew people going to respond to this? What is their response going to be? If you're a Hebrew, what is your response going to be when Moses comes in with these signs? I'm sorry? Who are you? That is something they do say. But when he performs these signs before them, what's their response going to be? I'm sorry? They're going to be excited. Somebody else over here? Absolutely, it could be something else. Well, let me read the passage here that shows you the response of the Hebrew people when Moses comes in with these signs. I'm reading from Exodus chapter 4, verse 30 to verse 31. Aaron spoke all the words that the Lord has spoken to Moses and did the signs in the sight of the people. And the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord had visited the people of Israel and that he had seen their affliction, they bowed their heads and worshiped. They speak the words of God. They perform the signs of God. They're excited. They're worshiping. Let's go. Let's leave Egypt. Now, we're going to start here in verse 1. And what I'm going to do is, I typically in teen class, we kind of work verse by verse by verse. So I'm going to start here in verse 1. And actually, let me go ahead and tell you kind of an overview of this chapter, kind of break it down. You can write this in the margins of your Bible, if that helps. Chapter 5, verse 1 to verse 5 is the confrontation between Moses and Aaron and Pharaoh. Verse 6 to verse 14 is going to be the opposition that they face. And then finally, verse 15 to verse 23 is going to be the effects of that opposition on the minds of Moses and Aaron and the people. All right? So if you didn't catch that, we're going to go through each one of those again. I'm starting in verse 1, Exodus chapter 5. Afterward, Moses and Aaron went and said to Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness." But Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and moreover, I will not let Israel go." So I'm going to stop right there. It's interesting because when Pharaoh says, "Who is the Lord?" this is not Pharaoh necessarily asking a question like, "Who is God? Tell me more about him." He's making a statement. Who is God? There's no reason for me to obey him. I'm not obeying him. And it's so interesting because if you're Moses, when Pharaoh makes this statement, something's triggering in the back of Moses' head. Because here's the ironic parallel. The way Pharaoh says this statement is something similar to what Moses said earlier in chapter 3. So what is the statement that Moses said earlier in chapter 3 that's somewhat similar to what Pharaoh just said in chapter 5? What is the statement that Moses said earlier in chapter 3 that's very similar to what Moses said, to what Moses said in chapter 3? Okay, can you go and read for us? So Moses says, "Who am I that I should obey?" And Pharaoh says, "Who are you that I should obey?" And do you know what both of those responses have in common? What do both those responses have in common? Both of those responses flow from an unbelief in who God is. Moses looks at himself and says, "I'm not enough, and God, I don't believe in you. I don't believe you're sufficient to cover my needs." Pharaoh looks at himself and he says, "I am enough, and I don't believe in you, and I don't need you in my life." But both responses, "Who am I?" and "Who are you? Why should I obey?" both flow from a place of unbelief in who God is. And so when Pharaoh makes this statement to Moses, hopefully that's triggering something in Moses' head. "Oh, I think I said that to you at one time." All right, let's look at verse chapter 5. And we're going to read verse 4 to verse 5. "But the king of Egypt said to them, 'Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people away from their work? Get back to your burdens.' And Pharaoh said, 'Behold, the people of the land are now many, and you make them rest from their burdens.'" So Pharaoh's pretty much flat out saying no, but I love what happens in verse 5 because it's almost like Pharaoh's thinking to himself, "No, you guys are not going to go, because what's going to happen is the whole Egyptian economy is now running on the Hebrew people. So if the Hebrew people leave, the economy is going to pause, all the building projects are going to be postponed, that pyramid he wanted built for the party next year is going to be postponed." Like, he's like, absolutely not, this is not going to happen. Now, here's the discussion question I want us to talk through for a moment. What did Moses expect to happen when he went to Pharaoh? Like, when Moses went to Pharaoh, what was the expectation of what he thought was going to happen? And then the second part of surprising or unsurprising about that outcome. So first of all, what was Moses' expectation? And number two, what is surprising or unsurprising about that? About what actually happened? That's, yes. I want to get to that in just a moment. Yes. So God did warn Moses some things were going to happen. But like, think about, what do you think Moses was thinking was going to happen when he went in? Exactly. And we also got to remember, too, that Moses is like an 80-year-old person right now. Like, he did not willingly go to Egypt. Like, God pretty much had to, like, pull him and drag him. Like, Moses is not wanting to do this in the first place, okay? And so when it took a lot of, like, all chapter 3 and 4 is God trying to convince Moses to go. And so when Moses finally goes, I think in Moses' mind, he's thinking, okay, I've obeyed now. I've now devoted full service to God. I devoted my full allegiance to God. Boom, there's going to be instant blessing and peace, and it's going to be a straight path forward because I got the signs, right? I think it's so interesting. And so what is unsurprising about that? And what is surprising about what actually happened then? So that's what Moses is thinking. So when he goes in, what is surprising and unsurprising about the outcome? And one of them was already mentioned. Surprising and unsurprising to Moses. Yeah, exactly. And so I'm going to build on that for a second. What is unsurprising about what actually happens is that God actually told Moses what was going to happen. He warned him. Yes, you're going in with signs. Yes, you've obeyed. But there's going to be some opposition. Look at chapter 3, verse 18 to verse 19. Chapter 3, verse 18 to verse 19. This is God speaking. And he says, "And they will listen to your voice. And you and the elders of Israel shall go to the kings of Egypt and say to him, 'The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us, and now please let us go on a 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand.'" So it's not surprising that there's opposition. What is surprising is what happens next. Moses knew there was going to be some conflict. What Moses didn't know what was going to happen was that in the next couple of verses, it doesn't just go from good to bad. It goes from bad to worse. It's not just Moses, it's not like Pharaoh just says, "Oh, you know, no, it's not going to happen. See you later." It goes from bad to worse. And that's what Moses was not expecting. That's what was surprising about what happened. And what we're going to see, and so just as a kind of a spoiler alert, this whole class is about disappointment. So exciting, right? So here's the question I want to ask you. Have you ever expected one thing from God only to get something that was more disappointing? Have you expected something from God, but in return got something that was disappointing? You don't have to share that. But at least, I want you to at least put that in your mind and think about that, because that's why I want to be in the central part of your brain as we work through this chapter 5. All right, next section. Exodus chapter 5, verse 6 to verse 14. This is the opposition. This is where things go from bad to worse. Start in verse 6. "The same day, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their foremen, 'You shall no longer give the people straw to make bricks as in the past. Let them go and gather straw for themselves.'" And so Pharaoh's like, look, they got too much time in their hands. They want to go out and have a party in the wilderness. Not happening. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to decrease the amount of materials that they have access to. And so for you economic majors out there, what's going to happen if you decrease the amount of materials that are available for your workers? What's going to happen? What's going to increase? I'm sorry? The labor, right? So if you decrease the amount of materials that are available, what's going to increase is the labor. So if it took you, let's say, I don't know, I'm just making this up. Let's say it took you one day to make 10 bricks. Now that you've decreased the amount of materials and you got to go searching for it, now it's going to take you a full day to make 20 bricks. All right, excuse me, it's going to take you a full day to make 5 bricks. So if it used to take you one day to make 10 bricks, now it's going to take you a full day to make 5 bricks. So he decreased the amount of materials, increased the amount of labor. Now, I want to look at this last part of verse 7. He says, let them go and gather straw for themselves. He is not, this is not Pharaoh giving them permission or advice. Like, okay, guys, you can go and gather straw. He's like, no, you guys are slackers. You guys are going to go and you're going to do this. Now, look at what happens in verse 8 and verse 9. It gets worse. But the number of bricks that they made in the past, you shall impose on them. You shall by no means reduce it, for they are idle. Therefore they cry, let us go and offer sacrifices to our God. Let heavier work be laid on the men, that they may labor at it and pay no regard to lying words. So you see what he did there? He says, I'm not just going to decrease the amount of materials. I'm not just going to increase the amount of labor, but I'm also going to keep the quota the same. So we just said earlier it took him a full day to make 10 bricks. Now it takes him a full day to make 5 bricks. Oh, guess what, guys? You still have to make 10 bricks at the end of the day. And so what Pharaoh is doing is he is making their burden and their work impossibly heavy. Impossibly. I mean, you thought your boss or your job was bad. I mean, this guy's crazy, but making their job terribly hard. So here's my question. Why is Pharaoh doing this? Like, what is his motivation for making it so hard for the Hebrew people? So he's trying to exert his authority, trying to show he's in charge, kind of push his weight around? Absolutely. What else? Trying to test? Like, you know, who is this guy? I don't think he's as powerful as you guys say he is. Absolutely. What else? Absolutely. Undermine Moses. And not just undermine Moses, but what else? Going back to what she was saying? Undermine God, right? And if you're trying to undermine Moses and you're trying to undermine God, if you're trying to suck the wind out of this whole let's leave Egypt movement, what's the best way to do that? Discourage the people, right? Because think about it. If you are so excited that Moses is going to come in and deliver you, and you're just so pumped about leaving Egypt, and then Moses is saying, you know what, I'm the deliverer, God has sent me, Yahweh, I am who I am, has sent me, and then all of a sudden, the same day, the exact same day he goes in, all of a sudden you don't get delivered out of Egypt, you're not leaving Egypt, and oh, by the way, your work just got way harder. So now they're not just mad at Pharaoh, they're mad at Moses. Because now they're going like, well, wait a minute. I thought you said you were the deliverer. I thought you said God was on your side. I thought you just performed these 3 signs for us. What happened to that? And so they begin to start doubting Moses as a deliverer. They start doubting God. They start doubting his words. That's exactly what Pharaoh wants. I mean, he's ingenious. Let's look at verse 10 to verse 14. So the taskmasters and the foremen of the people went out and said to the people, thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. Go and get your straw yourselves wherever you can find it, but your work will not be reduced in the least. So the people were scattered throughout all the land of Egypt to gather stubble for straw. The taskmasters were urgent, saying, complete your work, your daily task each day as when there was straw. Yeah, right. And the foremen of the people of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and were asked, why have you not done all your task of making bricks today and yesterday as in the past? And so now we have the supervisor starting to freak out. You know how at work you have like a supervisor above you, starts getting really crazy and starts putting a lot of pressure on you? Sometimes it's because he's got somebody above him, who's a higher management is putting pressure on him, right? You know what I'm talking about? That's what's going on here. We got big boss Pharaoh putting pressure now, and now the supervisors are starting to freak out, and they're starting to try to put pressure on the workers, but they know it's obvious it's impossible to meet this quota. They know this isn't gonna happen. So here's, before I go into this next question here, I'll go and pull it up. You guys don't have the benefit of, I have to give a little bit of context for this statement, because this is something we talked about in the teen class back in chapters 1 and 2. But here's the statement. God is working on a plan, and that plan is a good plan, but it will almost always play out differently than the way we think it should. Isn't that right? I mean, let me give you an example of that. When God went to Abram and said that he was going to turn this one son into a mighty nation, I'm pretty sure, at least before chapter 15, that Abram was not like, oh, and that's going to happen through slavery, right? Like, I don't think Abram was expecting that was God's plan. He knew God had a plan. He knew it was going to be a good plan, but he did not think it was going to play out the way it did. Because what happens? Abram's small family enters into Egypt. And when they leave Egypt, when they leave slavery, they are now a nation of millions. God has a plan, is a good plan, but it plays out way differently than we often think it should. So here's my question. How are we to survive God's plan when it plays out in ways that are disorienting and are confusing and it leads to disappointment? How are we to survive that? I'm sorry? We trust God, we have faith in God, absolutely, what else? So we're trusting, we have faith in him, and so that's going to lead to steadfastness? Absolutely. What else? Be obedient? Okay. I love that because for us, we're sometimes in the moments of the chapter fives in our lives, and we have the benefit of seeing the whole story. So we're like, oh, Moses, get over yourself. It's going to get better. But like, we are in the chapter fives of our lives, and we can't see the full story. So being able to go back and see the full story of characters in the Bible who are going through the same things we're going through, absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. In fact, I'm not probably going to talk about it in today's class. This is actually a chapter 6 class. But that's a great point. In fact, in Romans, you know, God talks about how, you know, the sufferings you're going through does not compare to the glories you're going to experience. And so having that in view, yes. Yeah, it's true. That's a good point. It's a great example of that. Absolutely. Like, talk about a massive good plan for our benefit and it being completely disorienting and confusing when he's being put in the tomb. That's a really good point, absolutely. Anything else? Yes. Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, absolutely. And so when you go through something and you come out on the other side stronger, now you're able to help other people who are going through the same thing. Yeah, I love that. Anything else? Yes. Yeah, praying for God, prepare me, because if I, we're going to get to this in the end, hopefully if I have time, but God promises, like, you're gonna suffer. And so praying that he'll prepare us for those moments when it comes. Wow, this is great comments. I really appreciate it. Anything else? All right, so I'm actually not going to tell you. Well, I just asked you, and you told me, but I'm actually going to save this for the end. So just keep that in the back of your mind. If we have time at the end, we'll try to cover some ways that we can survive God's plan when it plays out in ways that are disorienting and confusing. All right, let's finish up here in Exodus chapter 5, verse 15 to verse 23. This section here is the effects it has on God's people. Starting in verse 15. Then the foreman of the people of Israel came and cried to Pharaoh, "Why do you treat your servants like this? No straw is given to your servants. Yet they say to us, 'Make bricks.' And behold, your servants are beaten, but the fault is in your own people." And so what's interesting here is if you look very closely at verse 16, he says, but the fault is in your own people. He says, you guys have missed the mark. He says, you guys have missed the goal, what you're trying to accomplish, and you have sinned against the people, and you have failed the people. And look at Pharaoh's response here, verse 17 to verse 18. But Pharaoh said, "You are idle, you are idle." I don't know why that cracks me up. I mean, this is an intense moment, but Pharaoh's like, "You are idle, you are idle. That is why you say, 'Let us go and sacrifice to the Lord.' Go now and work. No straw will be given to you, but you must still deliver the same number of bricks." So Pharaoh's not budged. If you're a supervisor and you're walking out of that meeting, how do you feel right now? Look for another job. The problem is they're stuck in this job, so they can't leave. So yeah, exactly. So how are the supervisors feeling when they walk out of that meeting? Defeated? Okay, what else? They're angry? So who are they angry at? So what if I told you that when they walk out of the meeting, Moses and Aaron, I don't know why Moses and Aaron did this, but Moses and Aaron are actually waiting for them outside the meeting. So when they walk out of the meeting, who do you think they're angry with? Moses and Aaron. All right, let's see what happens here. This is interesting. Verse 20 and verse 21. They met Moses and Aaron, who were waiting for them as they came out from Pharaoh. And they said to them, "The Lord look on you and judge, because you have made a stink in the sight of Pharaoh and his servants, and have put a sword in their hand to kill us." They literally, what they're saying is, you have made a stink in Pharaoh's face. And on top of that, you have given him the sword and the reason to kill us and destroy us. And so may God look on you and judge you. And then they walk away. Like, they're furious, right? They're infuriated. And so they're now doubting Moses. They're now doubting God. They're now doubting his words. The people are now doubting God. They're now doubting Moses. They're now doubting his words. And look at the effect this has on Moses and Aaron. Look at the last few verses, verse 20 to verse 23. Actually, verse 22 to verse 23. Then Moses turned to the Lord and said, "O Lord, why have you done evil to this people?" I mean, can you imagine saying this prayer in a Bible study? You'd be like, okay. "Why have you done evil to this people? Why did you ever send me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people, and you have not delivered your people at all." So now Moses is angry at God. So Moses, I think, was thinking, you know, I'm going to obey, I'm going to have faith, this is going to work out, and there may be some bumps in the road, there may be some opposition, there may be some conflict. I don't think Moses ever dreamed in a million years he'd be at this point, at the end of chapter 5. Never. And I think he's thinking, why this? So here's the question I want to ask you. And I already kind of gave it away at the beginning. If we were to use one word to describe the tone of this entire chapter, what word would we use? If you were to use one word to describe the tone of this chapter, what word would you use? I'm sorry? Frustration? What else? If I had a whiteboard, I'd like to be writing these up here. Depressed? Frustrated? Depressed? What else? Anger? Disappointment. That's the word I'm looking for. Disappointment. The one word I would use to describe this whole chapter is disappointment. So here's my question for you. What are the results of disappointment when we face disappointments in our own lives? Like, when we are disappointed, and by the way, the teens were loving this. I was like, this is kind of weird. But when we face disappointment, what can be the results of disappointment in our lives? What can the effects be in our lives? It can make you stronger. But I'm thinking about some negative effects. Makes you feel like quitting. What else? I'm sorry? Depression. Makes you feel like you want to give up. Strike back in anger. If I can't control this, I'm going to try to, yeah. What else? Here's some things that I thought of. Disappointments can shatter our dreams. It can erode our confidence. It can highlight our limitations and inadequacies, and that can be a good thing or a bad thing, right? It can paralyze, here's a big one, here, it can paralyze our future decision making. And it's interesting because I heard someone describe it this way. If life, think of life as a sponge, okay? And when you soak a sponge in water, think of your life being soaked with dreams, right? So here's the sponge, it's your life, and it's full of water, it's full of dreams. Make sense? And sometimes what happens in life, not sometimes, it will happen, is that disappointment comes in and it wrings the sponge out. That so often we feel wrung out. That's where Moses finds himself right now. Moses has been wrung out. And so here's the question I want to go back to that I asked at the beginning. How are we then to survive God's plan when we are wrung out? And when we confront this disappointment and the negative effects it can have on our lives? And I wish I'd heard some of these responses before I made this class. Those were great responses. But here's just a few that I want to just quickly go over in the remainder of our time. And I'm going to read through these, and then we'll go through each one briefly. The first one is come to grips that we are broken humans living in a broken world. Number two is to read the Bible honestly. And number three is to look to the cross as objective evidence that God is for us. And so I think, first of all, we need to come to grips that we are broken humans living in a broken world. By the way, we do not live in a perfect heaven and earth, right? That was Genesis, that was before the fall, right? That was Genesis chapter 1 and 2. But we live in post-Genesis chapter 2, and so we have to remember that until that perfect heaven and earth comes where there's no pain and there's no tears, there's no sorrow, we're going to face these things. That's just the reality, right? And so I don't want it to get to the end of this and you go, all right, so the whole point was there's disappointment, yay. Like, that's not what I want to communicate. So I will go ahead and clarify. In the next chapter, chapter 6, God actually gives a response to Moses. And God actually reveals, he makes three identity statements about himself. And as God reveals more about himself, as we begin to know more about God, we begin to realize that there is purpose in the pain, there's purpose in the disappointment, that this is all leading to something, that Moses is a part of a story. He's not the main character. He didn't write the plot, but he's playing a part in it. But before we get to chapter 6, I think so often we want to rush past chapter 5 because chapter 5 is difficult. And so we want to rush past chapter 5 and get to chapter 6 to the good stuff. We want to see Moses shut down Pharaoh and give all those plagues and get the people out of there. But we have to remember, there was a chapter 5 in Moses' life. That Moses was experiencing heartbreak, that he was experiencing doubt, that he was experiencing disappointment. And I think that's so important because I think we have this perspective of some people in the Bible, especially Moses. Like, Moses is MVP in the Old Testament. I mean, he's like top 10 Hall of Fame in the faith in Hebrews chapter 11. He's a superhero. He doesn't experience heartbreak. He doesn't struggle with doubt. He doesn't experience disappointment. And don't we often view other Christians that way? Oh, that Christian, they're so spiritual. They're so amazing. They don't experience doubt. They don't experience heartbreak. They don't experience disappointment. And then when those things confront us in our lives, we then begin to think, well, does God forsake me? Does God not love me? Am I somehow less of a Christian now? And that's why I think it's so important for us to pause in these moments and realize that when these moments happen in our lives, that does not mean God doesn't love you. It doesn't mean he's not forsaking you. And it doesn't mean you're less of a Christian, because we all go through these things, don't we? We all go through those things. And that was something I was trying to explain to teens. Like, you know, as you go from teen to adult and then even past adult, like, these things are going to happen to you. And then at least this is the second thing, reading the Bible honestly. I don't know exactly where it's come from. And maybe it's because we Instagram and Facebook verses and just choose the happy ones. But I think so many people think that when I come up out of the water, it's just going to be like no temptation, no sin. It's just going to be perfect. It's going to be a straight shot to heaven. Be spraying Jesus dust everywhere. And so we have to read the Bible honestly, because the Bible tells us you will suffer. The Bible's realistic. It doesn't hold anything back. It says count the cost. Because when you follow me, it's going to be difficult. It's going to be worth it. But it's going to be difficult. Turn with me to John chapter 16, verse 33. John chapter 16, verse 33. This is right before Jesus' crucifixion. And listen to what one of the last things that Jesus wants his apostles to know. He says, I have said these things to you, that in me you may have peace. He says, I want you to have peace. I want you to have joy. In the world, you will have tribulation. You may have tribulation. Oh, it may come to you. It may hit you or miss you. He says, you will have tribulation, but take heart. I have overcome the world. And so I think it's so important for us that just because we obey God, just because we're doing everything he says, does not exempt us from disappointments in life. So I want to share with you a few quick examples, and these are not things, I don't even know why I'm doing this. It's very depressing stuff, I guess. But I'm going to give you an example here, and I want you to go to Matthew chapter 11. Matthew chapter 11. I want to give you a few examples here. Matthew chapter 11. This would be a great sermon series, right? Like, people who are disappointed in the Bible. Matthew chapter 11, verse 2 to verse 6. A little bit of context. This is about John the Baptist. John the Baptist has been spending his entire life out in the wilderness telling people that the Messiah, that Jesus is coming. And so when we get to chapter 12, Jesus is out in the streets preaching, and John the Baptist is in prison. And watch what happens. Chapter 11, verse 2 to verse 6. Now when John heard in prison about the deeds of the Christ, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another? So he's saying, all right, I'm in prison. I thought you were the Messiah. Are you really the one, or do we need to be looking for a different guy? Verse 4. And Jesus answered them, go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight, and the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear, and the dead are raised up, and the poor have good news preached to them, and blessed is the one who is not offended by me. Is there anything about that that's strange to you? What Jesus just did is he quoted Isaiah chapter 61. Now, here's the thing. John the Baptist, he knows his Bible. I mean, he's been raised in the scriptures since he was a little kid. And so it'd be like if I was to tell you, in the beginning, God created the heavens, and you could finish that sentence, right? Or if I say, God so loved the world that he gave, and you can already start finishing that sentence in your head. And so when the messenger, when John Baptist's messenger comes back and he starts quoting this verse that he knows very well, John the Baptist is already filling in the blanks. Okay, good news to the poor, lame are healed, the blind can see, boom, boom, boom. But Jesus skips something. He actually skips a section of that passage. What happened to proclaiming liberty to the captives and the opening of the prison to those who are bound? So Jesus goes through this whole list of things that he is going to do when he comes, and he skips the fact that those who are in prison are to be bound. You know what Jesus just did? He says, John the Baptist, I am the one. I am the Messiah. And you are not the one. And he says, you are going to stay in prison, and you are going to die in prison. And so here's John Baptist. He's obeyed God. He's did everything God has told him to, and yet he's still going to be disappointed. There's still going to be some difficulty in his life. And he says, listen, you're going to die in prison, even though he was faithful. And so, number one, we got to come to grips that we are broken humans living in a broken world. Number two, we got to read the Bible honestly, struggle through those difficult passages. There were people in the Bible who were doing everything right and still were killed, still suffered tribulation, still suffered. And then finally, and this is like the last, just a little glimpse of hope at the end. Look to the cross as objective evidence that God is for us. That when all else fails, we can look to the cross and go, that is the ultimate act that shows me that God does love me. Thank you for your time. Is that the final bell? Oh, there's another bell. Okay, so I got time for two more then. Awesome. I got time for even more disappointments. People are disappointed in the Bible. Let's do this. All right, Jeremiah chapter 1. Jeremiah chapter 1. This one I'm actually really excited. Gary and I were talking about this this morning. Jeremiah chapter 1. You guys are like, please stop. Jeremiah chapter 1. Jeremiah was a prophet to the people of Judah. And I want you to listen to what God tells him at the beginning of his ministry, what he promises Jeremiah. Okay, listen to this. I love this. Verse 9 and verse 10 of Jeremiah chapter 1. Then the Lord put out his hand and touched my mouth, and the Lord said to me, behold, I put my words in your mouth. See, I have set you this day over nations and over kingdoms to pluck up and to break down, to destroy and to overthrow, to build and to plant. Let me tell you, if God told that to me, I'm like, I'm in, right? Like, overthrow, destroy, use my words to, like, build up and tear down nations. I'm in. Like, let's do this, right? I mean, that's pretty cool, right? And yet, what happens in Jeremiah's life? What happens in Jeremiah's life? He's thrown in prison. People mock him. People despise him. Look what happens where he ends up in chapter 20. Jeremiah chapter 20, verse 7 to verse 8. This is right after he's been persecuted very intensely. In Jeremiah chapter 20, verse 7 and 8, listen to what he says. He says, O Lord, you have deceived me, and I was deceived. You are stronger than I, and you have prevailed. I have become a laughingstock. All the day, everyone mocks me. For whenever I speak, I cry out, I shout violence and destruction, for the word of the Lord has become for me a reproach and derision all day long. Did you catch what he just said there? He says, God, you have deceived me. He says, God, you lied to me. I mean, imagine a Bible study, someone praying a prayer like that. You'd be like, oh, I do not want to get struck by lightning, right? Like, he is admitting, like, God, I don't understand. I feel like you've lied to me. This is the same man who later writes the book of Lamentations, one of the most depressing books in the Bible. And so Jeremiah, he was faithful, he was doing everything God told him to do, and yet he still confronted disappointment. And the reason I want to bring up the Jeremiah thing for this reason, I think so often we're afraid to admit to God that we don't understand. I think we're afraid to admit to God that, God, there's things going on. I know you have a good plan. I know you're a good God. I know you love me. I know that the cross is objective evidence you love me, but I don't understand this, and I think we're afraid to admit that. And we have to be honest with ourselves and be honest with God. He knows our hearts. He knows what's on our minds. But he wants us to speak it and say, God, I don't understand. I don't understand. I know you're good, but at this moment, I just don't feel it. I love what happens with Jesus when he was healing somebody. He goes to one person, and this person says, I believe, but help my unbelief. He says, I believe that you can heal, but there's still unbelief. Help my unbelief. And that should be our prayer so often in these moments. God, I believe, but help my unbelief. All right, I still have one more. All right, yes. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And what's so cool, too, is even in these moments of quitting, there's other passages where we find Jeremiah getting flamed by the words of God within him. He says, I can't help but speak, even if it's going to lead to more disappointment. I can't help but speak because it's worth it. All right, 1 Chronicles chapter 28. First Chronicles chapter 28. This is, I'm going to start in verse 2. If you remember, King David, his dream was to build a temple for the Lord. I mean, that's what he's been dreaming for. He's been bringing all the materials together. He's got the plans. He's got the blueprint. He just needs A-OK to go. And listen to what happens here in verse 2. 1 Chronicles chapter 28, verse 2. Then King David rose to his feet and said, "Hear me, my brothers and my people. I had it in my heart to build a house of rest for the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and for the footstool of our God, and I made preparations for building. But God said to me, 'You may not build a house for my name, for you are a man of war and have shed blood.'" If you're David, you're like, wait a minute. I waged these wars and I shed blood because you told me to. Like, you were telling me to go in and fight these battles and to shed blood, and now you're telling me I can't build a temple because I've shed blood. You want to talk about disappointment? About not being able to see a temple you dreamed about building? I mean, talk about disappointment. He was faithful and still faced disappointment. And that's my last example. I appreciate your time. Thank you.